With me is Doug Fain. So, Doug, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You got it. All right. So just a little bit about Doug. He's a graduate of the Air Force Academy, Falcons. Yeah, there you go. And holds graduate degrees from Georgetown University and the University of Southern California. He flew more than 200 combat missions over Southeast Asia and was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for heroism, a Distinguished Flying Cross for achievement, 14 air medals, and an Air Force Commendation Medal. He is president of CEBG Incorporated, International Consulting Company, and has worked in more than 30 different countries in that capacity. He has taught for four universities. We've got to drive through it here. In both undergraduate and graduate programs, as an affiliate faculty member, and as a candidate in the U.S. Senate in 1992. Oh, excuse me. And that's why I keep water here. Doug has served on several boards and author of A Phantom Song, an award-winning novel about the Vietnam Air War. So, Doug, welcome. And tell us a little bit about the novel itself.
Well, the first novel, The Phantom Song, was a book I wrote originally in 1971, and I put it aside for quite a few years. It needed a chance to rest, I think. Then I took it back out about 40 years later, looked at it very carefully, decided that it needed some work, but the plot and the characters were still good. So I finished the book and got it published. I had a lot of fun with that book. It's, as I've told a lot of my friends, a third of that book is exactly the way it happened. A third of the book is true, but embellished, and a third of the book is just pure fiction. But now what I'm not allowed to do is explain which is which. That would get into a lot more discussions.
And so basically it's historical fiction, okay, and set in Vietnam.
Yes.
And forgive me, people. Yeah, I had the dry throat there. I think I'm okay now. So so in your personal experiences, how much – well, it's probably hard to quantify, so that's probably not a good question to quantify. But in the story itself, your life experiences there in Vietnam, how much of a role do you think it played in the writing?
Oh, I think absolutely it played a great deal. The book really is based on the lives of quite a few people. When the book finally was published and came off the printing presses, I told the publisher, I said, I want the first five books that you print. And he looked at me and he smiled. He said, I read your manuscript. I'll bet I could name the five people who you're going to give these books to. I said, you could, but you don't know the real names. And he said, well, that probably makes sense. But yes, it's based on observations and discussions and things I lived through and witnessed myself during that period of time.
Okay. And the characters themselves. Now, is there a dominant character in the story?
Oh, yes. There's a group of characters that are important, but there's several that are dominant. I would say that two of the pilots, a young man named Rob and one named Joe. I might just add that the real Joe died about a year ago. They were main characters, and of course, there is the female heroine in the book. Her name was Carrie. She was a surgeon, and very interesting story with the surgeons who were there on the base. Carrie being very important in the story, of course, and another man who's based on an individual who lives in Colorado now, who was also a great doctor, and he played a very important, this character played a very important role in the book as well.
And the setting, of course, is Vietnam. Is it like, is there combat in there? Is it like you were a pilot?
Yes.
And you mentioned a hospital, and I was thinking of MASH, you know, when you said that,
sure.
You know, that sort of thing. What is it? Is there actually hand to hand combat in it? Is it more of a story about these characters and their personal struggles, or which?
It's a bit of both. There's one of the scenes in the book that's one of my favorite. Was one of the characters had gotten himself into a very difficult situation mentally, and he was about to lose it, and he went out one night. He wasn't sure if he was going to commit suicide or not, And he went off out into the weeds, we call it, off the end of the runway. And he was sitting out there trying to get control of his life. And while he was there, a group of what we call sappers, enemy soldiers, came up and they were going to try to blow up the airplanes. And they walked past him while he was laying out in the grass, in this pretty high grass, maybe knee-high out in this field. And he, in order to save the people who were standing around outside, to let them know the sappers were coming, he fired at these guys and it started the battle. But there's one scene at the end where he's running across this field just after an aircraft has dropped napalm on the enemy positions. And as he's running across, I can envision it in my mind, this great huge fire lapping up into the air, and this dark shadow of Rob, this pilot, running across this field in front of that, trying to get to another location. And as he's running, he sees this enemy soldier lying on the ground, and he's alive, but very, very badly burned. And the enemy soldier is pointing to his own weapon and then to himself. And he's trying to tell this pilot,
right,
help me, kill me.
Yeah.
He's so badly burned. And the pilot takes his gun, and he reaches to pick up the enemy soldier's rifle, and it's too hot. It burns his hand. And he takes his own pistol, but his hand is shaking so much he can't fire. And finally, he gets both hands together, and the enemy soldier looks at him and nods, yes, and he fires and kills this enemy soldier. And then he runs on, and later is picked up and saved by the American troops. And at that point in the book, as he is going back into the base, he makes the decision that life is still too important, and that he still has things he needs to do, and he's okay. And he comes back ready to go back and live his life again. So that was one of the combat scenes. Most of the combat, what there is in the book, is actually an aircraft.
Yeah.
And, you know, airplane to ground, ground to airplane, and then airplane to airplane.
Okay. And I'm intrigued by this, Doug, when you're talking about, because what comes to mind for me is this moral dilemma that he finds himself in, that, you know, the enemy is down, he's wounded, and or incapacitated, and therefore he's not a threat. And yet there's this conflict, or in a sense, is, you know, that you're doing good by putting him out of his misery, and yet you sure really shouldn't shoot him. It seems to me, you know, and I'm not judging it at all, but I'm just saying, what is going through his mind then, the moral conflict that he's having with himself?
I don't think there was a conflict at all. In a case like that, a good man would make a quick decision. You have to, and I think he would make the same decision. The man was burned irreparably. He would never recover, no question.
Sure.
He would have nothing but pain and suffering, and would probably die within probably 15 or 20 minutes anyway.
Right.
And what he was doing was what I would call one of the more humane things you could do in a situation like that, even though he's one of your enemies.
Sure.
There's, in that same scene, there's a case where he runs and he dives in this ditch because he sees the airplane coming and he knows what's going to happen. And he jumps in this ditch. He thinks they're going to use their Gatling guns, but instead they drop napalm. And when he jumps in this ditch, there's two little boys who came with the enemy soldiers. They're little boys. And he looks at these two boys, and they're afraid of him. And he's looking at these boys, and he talks to them, and they can't understand what he's saying. But finally, he screams at them, run, run, go back and live your lives. Go live your lives. And he chases them off, and they run off into the jungle there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot in this book. There's a scene that I think is one of my favorites. This little doctor, who is a great surgeon, but he's probably 90 pounds soaking wet, and he's a pretty nerdish type of guy, and he doesn't fit in with this rowdy group of young fighter pilots. And he won't go into the officers' club to drink beer with the guys because he doesn't fit in. And at one point, he's this this doctor called Philip is talking to Carrie, the other surgeon, and a sergeant runs in screaming, "Grab your bag. We've got a pilot down behind enemy lines. He's been shot. We're going to have to work on him in the helicopter." And Carrie reaches for her bag, and Philip shouts at her as she comes over. He grabs the bag from her, and she says, "What's the matter? You don't think I can do this because I'm a woman?" Mm-hmm. And he looks at her and he said, "Carrie, this has nothing at all to do with your being a woman. It has everything to do with me being a man." And she understands what he's talking about, that he doesn't fit in. He's trying to find his own manhood, so to speak. And what she doesn't realize yet, he's madly in love with her. So he runs out. They go over. The chopper goes in to get this wounded pilot, and they take rounds, they take hits. And the big sergeant in the back is hit, the co-pilot's hit, and the chopper pilot pulls out immediately and pulls up. These guys were called the Jolly Green Giants. They drew pretty big helicopters to get pilots out from behind enemy lines. These were some of the bravest men in the world. And they're coming in real low and real slow in a bad environment. And when they're pulling up, the pilot pulls up, and the doctor, or Philip, runs in the back, and he's checking this sergeant that's hit, and he says he's going to be okay. And he looks at the co-pilot, and the co-pilot's hit, but he's going to be okay, but he's pretty bad off too. And the chopper pilot says, "We've got to get out of here." And Philip says, "You can't." And he says, "Why not?" He says, "If you leave, that pilot down there on the ground is dead." And he said, "Neither one of us can do that." And the chopper pilot says, "Well, what are we going to do? You know, Joe in the back, the sergeant, he's the one that goes down there to get them. And he's the one that brings them up on that winch, on this cable." And Philip looks at him. He says, "Well, we got three options. We can fly off and let him die. We can't do that." He says, "Number two, I can fly the chopper and you go down and get him. Or number three, you can fly the chopper and I'll go down and get him." Now, remember, Philip's about 90 pounds.
Right.
So the pilot looks at him and he says things I probably can't say over the radio about what kind of brave guy he is. And Philip says, "Well, I just hope I'm okay tonight." And so he goes down and the old sergeant talks to him, tells him how to find the guy on the ground. There's a technique. He tells him. He goes down and he finds the pilot. And the pilot weighed about 240. And he's been hit real badly, and he was hit for quite a while, so he's bled a lot. And while he's working on the pilot passes out. And he fixes him up, and he's waiting for the helicopter to come back in 15 minutes. And when he stands up, he hears something behind him. And he turns around, and there on the ground is an enemy soldier who's been shot by the pilot with a small pistol, .32 caliber pistol, that he had been carrying as a second weapon. When he goes over, he kneels down beside this enemy soldier, and he does what a doctor would do. He starts fixing him up. And when he gets through, and the whole time, the enemy soldier is conscious. He's looking at him. And there he's talking, Philip is talking constantly because he's afraid. But the pilot, of course, the soldier doesn't understand him. Well, when he gets through fixing him up, finally, he stands up and he looks at this man on the ground and he says, "If they find you pretty soon, you're going to be fine. You'll make it." And he turns around and there's two enemy soldiers there. One with a rifle pointed at him, a young man, and a very old soldier who's looking at him with complete shock on his face. And the old soldier walks over to the wounded one and he kneels down and they talk. And he keeps looking back at Philip, this American soldier who's a doctor. And finally, he looks at the man on the ground, and he tells the young soldier, "Take him into the village." And he gets the young soldier's rifle. And the young soldier is reaching over to pick up the wounded man. And when he does, Philip reaches over and grabs him, and he says, "Easy, easy." And he puts his arm, the arm of the enemy soldier, around the young man, and they kind of walk off down into the jungle. And the old man is standing there with the rifle pointed at Philip. And all of a sudden, in the distance, they hear the sound of the chopper returning, the big Jolly Green Giant. And as he's flying into position, the old soldier points the rifle at the ground and motions for Philip to leave. Go. And Philip walks over. He looks at him a moment. Then he goes over back to the pilot. And I have to remember names. He goes over to the pilot, and he can't pick him up. The pilot is too big. And he's just so upset that he can't pick Dick up. And he keeps trying to lift him. And there are tears just running down his face. And all of a sudden, a hand reaches over his shoulder. And it's the old soldier. And he lifts up the wounded pilot. And he puts the arm around the little doctor's shoulder. And he looks at him and he says, "Easy, easy."
Oh.
And at the end of this, the... Philip and the pilot are tied into the winch, and they're going up into the air into the chopper. And the old soldier is standing down below looking at them. And they both nod to each other, and the old soldier turns and walks into the jungle. Well, when they get back to the base, the chopper lands in the entire base. Everybody shows up when a chopper comes back with a guy they pulled out from behind enemy lines. And they've got the medics there, and they're taking him off to the hospital. But as they're doing that, all the people are cheering, and they're really having a party, so to speak. And as they slowly start leaving, and finally, Philip is standing there alone with just one other person, and it's Carrie, the woman he loves so desperately. And she looks at him, and she said, "Did you find the man you were looking for?" And he looks at her and he said, "Yes, I did." And she said, "Do you think you can live with him okay?" And he said, "Oh, yes, I can." And she said, "Wonderful." She said, "Let's go back to the hooch, the places where we lived. Let's go back to our hooch and get a beer." And he looks at her and he says, "No, let's go to the club and get a beer." And the last part of this chapter I wrote from her standpoint, watching him as he walks into the officers' club. It's just complete pandemonium with all these young pilots drinking beer and carousing and screaming, carrying on like crazy. And all of a sudden, there's total silence. And they all turn and they're looking at this little wimpy surgeon standing in the door with this other surgeon, Carrie. And the one guy who I haven't explained at all, who's one of the main characters in the book, he's a Colonel Bennett, and he is a wonderful man. Bennett looks up, and he just stands up from his chair, and he starts applauding. And the entire room bursts into applause. And the look on his face as Carrie watches him as he becomes one of the men.
Yeah.
And that was the end of that one chapter.
Wow. Yeah, that's very powerful, Doug. The images that were coming through for me as you're describing the scene, the conflict within the characters themselves, and then the notion of you have enemies, but in this world, the enemy went away, and it was the common humanity between them. And he had to experience that. And it's similar to the author was on earlier here. For me, we got talking about this internal struggle, the conflict that an individual has. And for this very underweight, what am I saying this way, surgeon who did not feel secure in himself or have a sense of confidence or anything, and he had to go and find that. And so circumstances played out, and then you have all these different elements that come into play. There's the wounded soldier, the enemy, and all this other comes in there. That's a very, very powerful, not only scene you're creating there, but I think it's a universal, type of, situation. I used to, when I taught English, I would teach, Red Badge of Courage.
Yes.
And Stephen Crane. And then we would talk about the realistic authors that we're after. And the metaphor for the literal battlefield that you write about, and then the general battlefield of life where we are, yeah, you know, in here. Okay. That just in our day to day to day, you know, and we can say it's politics or religion or whatever it is here. And we take our stands like this, but then something happens and we move past that to recognize that the humanity of that person who was the enemy over there is all of a sudden gone there. And I think you're capturing it there in that story.
Well, one of the things that made that particular chapter, I think, strong was I was trying to show that in the chapter just prior to that, it was Dick's story. He's the 240-pound pilot who was down there.
Right.
He gets shot down, and his navigator and he bail out, and you don't come down together necessarily. And he finally finds his navigator hanging in a tree in his parachute. He couldn't get out. He was 20, 30 feet off the ground, hanging in his parachute, caught up in the tree, and the enemy soldiers had just shot him. He was still, his gun was still in his
pistol. Is he dead?
He's dead.
Okay,
he's
so
dead.
Not wounded.
Hang and he's looking for this guy who's not only his navigator, but his friend, somebody he cares about very much. And he finds the guy, and he himself is very wounded at this case. There's a, how he gets wounded is very important. One, a couple of enemy soldiers come up, and one of them is just absolutely cruel. Not only to the American pilot who's been shot down, but to his own cohorts. And he's just an evil man, you can tell. And when they find Dick, he is stunned and he's laying on the edge of this creek. And the guy goes over and walks up and puts his pistol to the back of Dick's head and pulls the trigger. And Dick is thinking all the things you would think when you realize I'm being shot here any second. But the man's gun misfires. So he takes Dick's weapon, a .38 caliber that every pilot carried, and he puts that to the back of Dick's head, and he pulls the trigger. But it's empty, because the pilots, you never knew if you wanted bullets or if you wanted flares. You could put either one in your pistol. And a lot of people carried them empty, but they carried a second revolver under their flight suit, a small handgun, a .32 caliber, kind of a pea shooter almost. So when the guy tries the second gun and it doesn't fire, he just kicks him a couple of times and turns around to walk back to the other soldier. And they're going to strip his boots and whatever he's got of value. And Dick realizes it's now or never. And he's hurt badly at this point. He's already been shot and hit once by these guys with a rifle. And he reaches in real carefully and pulls out the .32, and he just rolls over and just starts shooting. And he shoots both of the guys and immediately reloads and shoots them again several times. And then he crawls up, and the guy who had put the gun to the back of his head was still alive. And he crawls over to him and says a few things, and he says, I'm going to give you the same chance you gave me. And he puts the guy in the middle of the gun in the middle of the guy's head and fires. And then he crawls off and finds his friend. So in that chapter, you're seeing the absolute horrific horror of man's humanity to other men. And in the next chapter, you see the opposite. Two men, the humanity comes out.
Right.
And I have a similar situation in my new novel, 2040 American Exodus. It's just been published. There's the case of these two young men. It starts out when they're both about 11 years old. And one of the young men is, at the beginning of this chapter, he's hiding behind a couch in an old, decrepit apartment house, and he's frightened. He's terribly frightened. He's trembling. His drunken father is beating his mother. And he's lying there under this couch, hiding, and he begins to realize that tomorrow will come, and the next day, and the next. And for the rest of his life, he will know what he did that night. And he pushes the couch away, and a terrified 11-year-old boy stands up and goes in to try to stop his father from beating his mother. The very next chapter is the other character, and he's sitting in the back of a congressman's office listening to his father manipulate two men and he watches this carefully, and he realizes in his young mind, this is how you get what you want in life, manipulation. And he determines that he's going to learn how to do that very well. And these two young men end up together as roommates in college, and where they become friends. And then later, they become enemies as they go through their lives. And the story is a lot about them. There's one case where there's one battle scene in this book. Both of these young men end up in Afghanistan at about 2030 or 2035. They're still fighting there. And they get ambushed. The convoy they're with gets ambushed. And one of the men who will be later very important in the story, whose name is Donnie. Donnie is running across this road to get to the other side of the road during the ambush, and he's hit. And he falls into the road, and he's lying there, and he can't move. And he and bullets are just ricocheting off the ground all around him. And he knows it's just a matter of time before they hit him. Well, the one young man, Mark, who's the young man who thinks about what he'll have to face himself tomorrow, he's there and he tells several of the men, the snipers are up there on the right-hand side of that big rock formation. Just start shooting in that direction as fast as you can so they'll duck. I've got to get Donnie out of the road. And one of the men says, you put one foot in that road and you're a dead man. And then Mark says something to the effect, I've got to. How would I face myself tomorrow if I don't? And he runs out and he grabs this young man by the belt and his collar. He drags him across the street and they fall into this big ditch on the other side of the street and they make it. And it's very important because that event has a big impact on the rest of the story toward the end of the book.
Right. Yeah, and the conflict. And before we go on discussion, I do just a station identification. Everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9. And this is The Rabbit Hole and the Writer's Talk segment of it. Visiting here with Doug Fain, who has written a couple novels here. The Phantom Song, which I do want to get back to here, another question on it too, in a minute there. And then 2040, which is more of futuristic, if you will. And we're just starting to talk about that a little bit there. Do want to thank Dex for sponsoring this hour. And if you need any information, it's 1-800-CALL-DEX or get to dexknows.com. And well, thanks again to all our sponsors. If without the sponsors, we wouldn't even be able to put this out live and talking to great people like Doug Fain and other authors that come on in and talk about their works. And of course, remind everybody, we are recording this and we'll have it on the website and on my website. And you can hear the rebroadcast on Monday at about 3 o'clock. We went on a little bit after, but that's okay there. Then we're going to come back to Exodus, but and maybe this will tie it. Actually, no, it could tie in with both novels, because you were talking about the one of the scenes in the Phantom Song about the man and the napalm, and he was lying out in the grass and everything too, and he was just like out of, you know, and what came to mind for me, Doug, is PTSD. And we're hearing more and more of it. I have a young friend who told me I hadn't seen her for some time, and her brother recently committed suicide. And,
sorry to hear that.
Yeah, he was over in Afghanistan, Iraq, he did like three tours of duty and just,
a lot.
And, you know, just kept getting bounced around. And so I'm, you know, and I think back, I'm the same generation as you. I remember
young guys.
Yeah, exactly here. And what you bring back, what a soldier can bring back. And of course, everyone's different, but they bring, you know, these memories or whatever. And so, and I was that one character you were talking about there, and that's what made jump into mind for me, was this concept of PTSD. Do you address that in the stories, or how does it come out there?
I
want to hear this. Yeah,
actually I spend some time on it in 2040 American Exodus.
Okay.
There is a chapter there. It's funny you mentioned that. There's a chapter there where Mark, the young man who was hiding behind the couch. Mm-hmm. He's the good guy in the book, where Mark is out and he's up on Echo Lake, up there by the lake. It's early spring, still mm-hmm. snow on the ground.
So Echo Lake here in right here. Oh, good. Yeah. So it's very local.
Oh, yeah.
Yay! All right,
nice. Good bit of the book happens here.
Yep.
And he's up on the lake, and his adopted father comes up to see him. Now, his adopted father is really a neat guy. He's a pastor in a small church, and he's got a good view of life, what life's really all about. And he's a good guy, but he's always trying to help look after Mark, because Mark's the only, is an adopted son, but the only son he ever had.
How old is Mark at this point?
Mark is probably at that point, I'm guessing, about 23.
Okay, so young man.
Yeah,
okay.
He's young,
okay.
Young man.
Okay.
And so the father, his name is Ken, and Ken walks up to him while Mark is looking out at the lake at one point in the story. And Mark looks over at him and he said, "Let's see, you're here to find out if I'm okay." This is right after Mark has come back from Afghanistan.
Okay.
He says, "You're here to see if I'm okay, right?" And Ken looked at him and he said, "Well, I just wanted to chat." He says, "No, I know why you're here." And they talk about this. He says, "Dad, there are some men who come back, and women, both men and women,
right.
who come
mm-hmm.
back, and they have severe problems." And he said, "There are others who come back, and I don't know why, but they're okay." And he said, "I've thought about it." He said, "I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that you gave me a foundation that helped me know myself and understand my place in the world that made it a lot easier." And he said, "Dad, I'm okay. I'm okay." And Ken says, "Are you sure?" He says, I'm sure. And he says, "As a matter of fact, the reason that I was out today, I was visiting with a friend who's not okay." Mm-hmm. And the father says, the old pastor says, "Is he drinking?" And Mark says, "A lot." And the pastor says, "Well, you know where to start. You know where to start." Mm-hmm. And so they talk about it a bit there in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's some powerful stuff here. And I think it's as we become more cognizant as a society.
Sure.
You know, that when these young people, and even older, and we'll say people because it's men and women now,
sure.
and they're there, and even if they're not in immediate combat, it seems, you know, that maybe they're like surgeons or something in the hospital and the MASH units, whatever they are now, you know, to see the horrific side of war.
Yes.
You know, that I remember the... you know, on one of the old MASH, Henry Blake there, and he says, there's, you know, two things about war. One is, and he put it in context of male, young men die. That's rule number one. And rule number two is you can't change rule number one.
Yeah.
Is it? And it's not pretty that's there. And, you know, we go through just in, you know, again, the battlefield of life, just coming back. I don't want to jump in, you know, good way out there on that. But the metaphor that's there, that with your storytelling and these characters, that I'm seeing that even if one is opposed to war or whatever, could read this work and start to understand the
sure.
conflicts that they have, the moral dilemmas. One of the questions I would have had, you know, like when the one who shot the enemy soldier in the other novel that was dying, you know, had severe, and it was the enemy soldier, and he said, "Please, you know," and put him out of his misery, would have died 15 minutes later. If he were an American soldier, would he have done the same thing?
That's a good question.
That's
very,
that's what it comes into.
Would be
yeah.
Very tough.
Yeah.
Very tough. The, one thing I might mention, the Phantom Song got second place in mainstream fiction in the Paul Gillette Writing Awards. And they had a banquet for the authors to come to, and we had a really nice time, met a lot of fine people. And while I was there that night, one of the judges came up to me, and he was an older man, and he said, "Did you write the Phantom's Song?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I loved your book." I said, "Well, I'm glad you did, but I'm surprised it won an award, being military in nature." And he looked at me, he said, no, your book isn't about war. Your book is about some very interesting people who just happen to be in a war. And one of the things I found writing about when the situation is in a war, and there's, you know, one battle scene even in the 2040 American Exodus, what I found is you're in a situation where you can put your character under intense pressure very rapidly and have them do things that they would do or not do under that much pressure. If you're in a normal environment of everyday life, it would take years for a person to reach a point of shooting that soldier, for example. It would take years for anybody to get to a point to where they would do that. Whereas in the middle of a combat situation and bullets are flying, you can put your characters under a lot of stress and you could do it in a relatively short period of time. And so I had one of my pilots in the Phantom Song. He gets shot down and he hides in this bamboo thicket. And he crawls up in there. And the interesting about this particular pilot, he was perhaps the finest pilot that ever set foot in an airplane. He was a pilot's pilot. He was the best. And when a fighter pilot like me says that about somebody else, you know he's good, if I will say that about him. And he was good. Well, in the book, his name is Joe. Well, Joe crawls up in this bamboo thicket, and for the first time in his life, he's terrified. And he does what most any human being would do. He crawls up in that thicket, pulls the weeds in behind him so they can't find him, and he gets in a fetal position, and he's laying there trembling, and he's frightened, just scared to death. And all of a sudden, he hears the enemy soldiers, and they've caught his navigator. And he can look between the bamboo and barely see they have his friend. And they're torturing and murdering his friend. And he lies there, and he's thinking he can close his eyes so he can't watch, but he can't close his ears. And he hears the screams. And it affects him terribly. When he comes back, later, when the enemy leave, he crawls out and they bring in a Jolly Green. They find him, they bring him back. And he gets back, and he walks out to get in his airplane, and an F-4, the fighter, has a ladder. They're yellow. Big metal yellow ladder that just reaches up and hooks on the side of the plane, and you climb up those probably 6 steps into the front of this big fighter aircraft. And when he grabbed anytime he grabbed that ladder, he heard the screams, and he couldn't fly. And he walks in and he tells the wing commander, here's my wings. I can't do this anymore. And the wing commander knows this is the best pilot he's got. And he says, look, you go out there and work and be the guy that works on the desk out there for a while till you get yourself straightened out. But I want you back in that airplane. And he can't do it. And finally, something happens that's very dramatic in that book. A very, very important event occurs. And at that point, his best friend, Rob, runs out and says, I've got to go. I'm the only one that can stop this. And he runs out to get in this airplane. And Joe looks at him and says, wait, I'm going with you. And Rob looks at him and says, do you think you can do this? And he says, I've got to. And he knows he can't let Rob go off because Rob's a good pilot, but Joe's the best. So Joe gets to the plane and he runs at that yellow ladder. He just runs at it as hard as he can, like he's attacking it. And he grabs it and he just climbs as fast and hard as, and he's screaming. And he jumps in the front. And he sits there and he's trying to crank this airplane. The crew chief is out there and he's giving him the signal and they have to have air pressure to start it. And he hears the screams and he sits there and he grabs the throttles and he grabs the stick that you control the plane with, and he's holding them as tight as he can. And he's listening to the screams, and all of a sudden he hears drums. And there's drums in the background. And the drums get louder. And then it becomes a song. Now, one of the important things early in the book is that his navigator, when you fly into combat with somebody day after day, they become your brother. They're not just another guy. They're special. They've been there with you. You guys have been through life and death together. And he's sitting there and he's hearing his navigator would always hum or sing while they were debriefing the plane. And what he would sing was Guantanamera, the song Guantanamera. And he's sitting there grasping the stick and he's listening to these screams and the drums in his ears and his mind. And all of a sudden he hears this little sound in the background and he's focusing on that little sound and it's a song and he's listening so hard. And all of a sudden he recognizes it's Guantanamera and he leans back and he lets go of the stick and the throttle and he leans back and he looks at the crew chief and he gives him the signal, start it up.
Yeah.
And he taxis out. And as they get out to the end of the runway, Rob looks back at him and he says, "You okay?" He says, "Never been better." Yeah. And they take off to go save the mission and save the world
right. With
what they were about to do.
Yeah. It's very powerful, this what you're describing there. And I just feel and see, because I see your face here and here the audience can hear your voice too, because it is very personal, very powerful story there. And what the gentleman at the award ceremony had said, that what you're writing about is the human condition, my yes. words here a little bit, but in this case here, it's in a setting of war is what
sure.
you're doing. So these traumas that we endure, they're universal. We all feel them in different context.
Yes.
You're bringing it to life, though, in context of this very vivid thing right there. It's called war and blood and guts and,
yeah.
and so forth there. And for this man to hear, like you said, he can close his eyes, but he can't close his ears. Even if he tried to, he's still going to hear it. And then that just, becomes part of him in that it just yeah. locks in his brain. How do we move past it? And that's kind of like the PTSD,
and
too.
And he was so embarrassed that he did nothing while he was hiding there. That was the worst part to him, was
yeah.
that he laid there and did nothing.
Yeah.
And what can you do if a group of enemy soldiers has your friend there 20 feet away and you've got a, pistol?
Okay.
Yeah. What can you do? But for a man to face yourself every day and think about the fact that you laid there and you did nothing
mm-hmm.
while they were torturing and murdering your friend.
But the question is, could he have done something? He had one. Yeah, I mean, it would have been, then he would have been dead or
yeah.
tortured next.
Yeah.
And so, again, that moral dilemma that comes in. That's why I find this pretty fascinating here, because it's not an easy answer that comes out of here.
And either way, you're going to lose.
Yes.
If you rush out there and try to save your friend, chances are you won't. You'll be killed too. But if you don't and you do nothing, then you spend the rest of your life living with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what was his problem.
And we could do that in just general life in terms of maybe your friends being just verbally assaulted, but you didn't stand up for them or whatever. And then you know.
Right.
So again, that metaphor, symbolism of the human behavior here, it's
sure.
It's universal, what you're doing here, what
yes,
you're creating
is.
Them too. So I think what that man said to you at that, award ceremony, when you were saying, I'm going, yes, cause I taught English, literature, and we would look at these, the conflicts of the individual, the characters themselves, and because characters were not flat people.
No.
We're very complex.
And even your good people
mm-hmm.
have some bad parts to them.
Right.
And the bad guys have some good as well.
Right.
And I saw the trade-off between the two so often in my new novel, in that I had Mark and I had Alec, who were two totally different people who were opposed to each other throughout most of the book. And the way they viewed life and the way they reacted to it was quite different. And then you had the old Pastor Ken in the background, who was always telling Mark, the anger will eat you up, not him. Mm-hmm. You've got to get beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to do something here while we're... So, yeah, the reasons I'm also saying this to you, and, you know, we talked briefly about 2040, and maybe just before I go on with my statement here, because sure. We got about 5 minutes left here. So, talk more about the 2040. You touched on it before about the two boys.
Yes.
And, because when we were talking before we went on the air, you know, about being Orwellian, I used a concept, dystopian, if you will.
Yes.
And so just to give the audience a little bit of overview, what this is, novel is about.
Okay. The title again is 2040 American Exodus. And what prompted this book was I was sitting with a group of my friends, probably a year ago, a group of men, and we were sitting around. And we were talking about the changes we've seen in our lifetimes. And many of those are wonderful. We're doing a lot of things well today in our society, but there's some things we aren't doing very well. One of the primary ones that comes to mind to me is the idea of the federal debt, for example. I happen to be an engineer, but I have a graduate degree in economics from Georgetown, and I've taught economics for many years in several universities. And I have a feel, we were explaining to each other that no one seems to understand how big $1 trillion really is, and what the impact of a $20 trillion debt will be to our children and grandchildren. And to make a long story short, one of the men finally said, well, what can we do? You know, we're older men, and the world doesn't really care what we think anymore. We are becoming invisible. And I said, well, I think what I'm going to do is write a book. And because I want people to read it, I'm going to make it another novel. And quite frankly, I love novels anyway. I much prefer that to the nonfiction. But I said, I'm going to write a book and try to give an idea what the next two, three decades might look like, depending on what happens in this country. So you end up with these two young men. One, Mark, goes off and becomes a brain surgeon. The other, Alec, becomes eventually the chief of staff to the president of the United States. And in the process, Alec is somewhat responsible for the death of the finest brain surgeon in the world, who is the mentor to Mark, who is studying under this man. He's like a second father to him. And when the surgeon is killed, Alec can't get over it, and he blames, I'm sorry, Mark can't get over it, and he blames Alec. And that starts the problem between these two men. Mm-hmm. And it goes through, as the country is moving forward, a lot of things going right, a lot of things going wrong, and in the midst of all this, you've got these two men who are very much opposed to each other. And, of course, there's the young woman, Mackenzie, mm-hmm. who they both fall in love with immediately. She's beautiful. You'll notice on the cover of the book that the young lady on the right, her hair is red. Mm-hmm. I might mention that the artist who did that, who prepared the cover, is a redhead herself. So she made
nice.
She made Mackenzie's hair red. That's Lorna Club. Mm-hmm. Did a great job on that, and we've had a lot of good comments back from her work on it. I have to apologize if she's ever listening, because I had her change the cover a number of times in sizing. I found out that the spine of the book is determined by how many pages there are, and guess what? Yeah. What the color of the paper is.
Yeah, exactly.
If it's white paper, it's thinner.
Yeah, exactly.
If it's the cream color.
Off-white, the cream,
yeah. If it's cream, it's thicker.
Welcome to the world of self-publishing.
And so all of a sudden, I would call her and say, guess what? I just changed the page count by 35 pages when I changed to the other color.
Yeah.
But she did a great job, and
that's great.
It was fun.
Awesome. Well, you know, I'm just intrigued. So thank you. It was, you know, fantastic conversation. I apologize for my initial coughing fit at the beginning there, but I think once we get into it, it sounds like you're, you know, very intriguing stories. Like I said about the gentleman at the award ceremony saying that, you know, you're putting in context of war, but it's human behavior, the human condition. You know, these characters were very complex. You know, we have good sides, bad sides, and even enemies in Vietnam to show humanity, you know.
As one writer to another, let me give you one little quick story on 2040, American Exodus. I was at the Colorado Authors League big holiday book sale recently. And a man walked up. Well, first of all, if I had a dollar for every woman who came up and said, my husband doesn't read, and one lady looks at me and says, my husband doesn't read. In fact, he doesn't think. I got a good laugh. But one man walked up and he said, I don't read. And I said, I'll tell you what. And I handed him 2040, American Exodus, and I said, read the first page, just the first page. He said, all right. And I walked over and I was talking to a fellow author over there. 25 minutes later, he's still there reading.
Nice.
And I walked over and my friend next to me said, maybe you should consider renting these books rather than selling them. And I said, that's a good idea. So I walked over to the man and I said, I reached out to take the book back. And he said, no. I've got to see how this turns out. I said, see, you do read.
You do read.
You do read.
And that's it, getting hooked in the story. All right. So, Doug, thank you so much for coming in. And, if people wanted to get a copy of your book, Amazon?
Both books are on Amazon.
Okay.
And 2040 American Exodus is also on Kindle.
Okay.
And you can pick it up either place.
Okay, great. And your website, you were telling me you're working on it.
The website is douglasfain.com, and it's about 3/4 of the way finished. In fact, this morning I sent some more information over to the webmaster to include, but okay. You know, check it out. Scott's got some good information.
So it's a work in progress, but you're getting there. Yeah, I know all about that there. All right. Hey, everyone, this is Jerry Fabian.